public meeting on the Chilcot report, and we're really pleased that we've got Lindsay German here, who's the convener of the Stop the War Coalition, and some of us have known her a long time since our green banner was first made. I think we can proudly say it's been on every anti-war demonstration in London and out lots of times in Chesterfield as well. And Jenny Pereira, who's our treasurer and couldn't be here tonight, reminded me that she went down actually for the opening of the Chilcot inquiry, which was as long ago as 2009. So it may feel like history to some people, but we lived through it all, many people in the room. And please give Lindsay a very warm welcome.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Jeannie, and it's a pleasure to be here and in front of this banner, which is definitely I can remember seeing on a whole number of occasions, and very, very many congratulations for everything that you do in Chesterfield and around here. I know from talking to a number of people, there's a very high level of activity around the drones in Waddington, over the Menwith Hill, as well as all the things that we ask you to do, that CND asked you to do, that people do. So thanks very much for that. What I want to talk about tonight is a little bit about Chilcot. As Jeannie said, this was a commission which was set up in 2009 by Gordon Brown because he couldn't get away from the fact that people didn't like Tony Blair. And every time he talked about, you know, how can Labour win the next election and all this kind of thing, this big question of Tony Blair and of the Iraq War kept coming up and kept spoiling all the things that he was trying to do. So his solution was, well, have an inquiry. There'd already been three inquiries, actually. There'd been a parliamentary inquiry and Hutton and Butler, all of which had been really whitewashes, all of which hadn't told the truth in any sense about what had gone on in the run-up to the Iraq War, which I think is what many of us were concerned particularly about, because we were all campaigning madly in 2002-2003, and on February the 15th 2003 we had the biggest demonstration ever in British history and still didn't stop the war. So I think we were all very concerned, I'm sure everybody here was, you know, how can we get to the truth of this and how can we get justice? So didn't expect too much from Gordon Brown or indeed from the people who set up the Chilcot Inquiry, which was composed, as you can imagine, not of people who, ordinary people like ourselves, who might have a view on it. It was, three knights and a baroness, I think, were the composition of the Chilcot Report, which gives you an idea, you know, it was very much an establishment report. In fact, last week, what came out, a guy called Chris Lamb spent 2 years getting freedom of information, put in a freedom of information request about the Chilcot Report. The headline, which was in the Independent last week, says it all, revealed Chilcot Inquiry was set up to avoid blame. So that tells you, no, they didn't want anybody to blame. It was always set up without any legal standing. So you couldn't have barristers. Now, you may or may not say that's a good thing, but you couldn't have barristers and legal argument and all that sort of thing. And that meant there couldn't be any legal outcome, that nobody could turn around at the end of Chilcot and say, OK, Tony Blair or anybody else is going to be off to The Hague. So that was quite deliberate. And in this report that came out a couple of weeks ago, it said that they were very, very concerned that the inquiry would investigate too much. Many of the officials involved in setting up the inquiry, including former MI6 chief Sir John Scarlett — he wasn't a sir then, but of course they get that as a kind of reward for services rendered — and Gus O'Donnell, Sir Gus O'Donnell, now Lord Gus O'Donnell, so he's gone even further up the thing. They deliberately appointed a woman who was already involved in Iraq policy and therefore shouldn't have been appointed, but she was there obviously very, very clearly to make sure that nobody did get too much blame with it. So I don't suppose any of us had massive illusions in what was going to happen with Chilcot, and perhaps some of us had even forgotten it was going on, so long was it that it took place. And even one of the members of the inquiry died while it was going on, and with all these rather tasteless kind of jokes that maybe the whole commission would die before it actually managed to report. But no, Chilcot did report in July this year, and actually, to, you know, to give him credit, and I don't think we should give him too much credit, but to give him credit, he did. I think he was probably kind of thoroughly annoyed because everybody started blaming him for the fact it was taking so long, when it was actually Tony Blair and George Bush who were delaying the process and stopping all of the information from coming out. And I think he got so annoyed that he decided he would be more forthright than you would normally expect from these kind of reports. And we, as Jeannie said, we had a demonstration the day it started. I think we had a couple of other demonstrations sort of come in while it was going on. And then we had one, obviously, on the day that it reported, and Blair was inside, the families were all inside, the families of the soldiers who died in Iraq, who, I have to say, in when it was set up in 2009, really did think this would bring them some, you know, satisfaction and some closure about their children's death and all this kind of thing. So they had a lot of faith in it, and they were getting more and more disgusted as it went on. So anyway, we all kind of assembled down in Westminster, and I thought, well, this will be the usual whitewash. To be perfectly honest, I didn't think it would be particularly good. And I got a phone call from a guy who's a journalist on one of the press agencies, who's a very nice guy and tells you all sorts of things that he probably shouldn't. And he said, he phoned me just while Chilcot was reporting. He said, this is really, really damning of Blair. It's really, really horrendously damning of Blair. It's much worse than any of the politicians and most of the media were expecting. So then, of course, we found out what was going on. Now, what did it actually say when you look at what Chilcot reported? Because, of course, they never, those sorts of reports never say Tony Blair is a liar. You know, you could go into a pub in Chesterfield or probably any other town in the country, and this wouldn't be a controversial point. And it would be, indeed, you might get a drink bought for you if you said this kind of thing. But that isn't how government reports work, that you're not allowed to say he's a liar, you're not allowed to say they deliberately lied and misled everybody and all this kind of thing. But Chilcot came pretty close to doing some of these things. And what he actually said the war was unnecessary. There didn't need to be an Iraq war in 2003. I mean, what he actually said was maybe, possibly 10, you know, a few years afterwards, maybe there would have been a case for it, but there was no case for it in 2003. And what were the main points that he said? He said there was no imminent threat from Saddam Hussein to Britain, or indeed pretty much to anywhere else. There really wasn't that threat there. There were no weapons of mass destruction. Now, I don't know if people remember when that claim was first made that weapons of mass destruction from Saddam could hit British interests in 45 minutes. Certainly in London, it was the headline of the London Evening Standard. And that lie went round the world that, you know, in 45 minutes, he's got these missiles that can hit, could hit British bases in Cyprus, because of course they couldn't hit Britain, but that was, you know, this was the story. That was simply not true. There weren't any weapons of mass destruction, and that was proved by the fact they'd never ever found any. Mm. Never ever found a single thing in Iraq, anything coming close to the weapons of mass destruction. The third thing that Chilcot said was that it was a failure of democratic accountability and government. Now you can say that again when you actually look at it, because what happened there, you know, if you know, I mean, I many, many years ago studied British constitutional law and all this kind of thing, and, you know, there's meant to be the separation of powers, there's meant to be checks and balances on crazy governments that do all sorts of mad things, there's all sorts of legal officers who work for the government, who are civil servants, who are meant to stop them doing anything illegal. There's collective cabinet responsibility, and of course there's the scrutiny of Parliament. Now, all of that went out of the window. I mean, with a few honourable exceptions, there's a woman called Elizabeth Filkin who resigned, who was a legal officer of the government, who resigned, I think, the day before the war started. But in that, I mean, I barely noticed that, and I was pretty engaged at the time. It was something that was covered up, really, that there was so much going on, there was such a drive to war. She resigned because she felt that the war was illegal and that she couldn't possibly be part of it. It's absolutely clear when you look at the evidence that the Attorney General started off by saying this war is not legal and ended up by saying, oops, it's legal. And you can see these documents where Blair writes on one of them when he says, I don't think this war's legal. This is a few months before. Blair writes, you know, scribbles on the side of the thing. He goes, I really don't understand this. You know, how can anybody say that this war is illegal? So, you know, in other words, go away and do your homework until you come back with the right answer was really what he had to do. So this complete failure of democratic accountability and government. And the final thing that Chilcot said that was of real significance, I think, was that Bush and Blair between them acted to undermine the authority of the United Nations and were determined to carry on preparing for war come what may. And that, to me, in a way, is the most damning thing. You know, if you look, and again, this isn't new with Chilcot. I mean, there's been various books that have been written, including by a Washington journalist called Bob Woodward, who wrote about this in the run-up to the Iraq War, where it's absolutely clear that when Blair goes to the ranch, you know, the Bush's ranch in, when was it, March, April 2002, they made an agreement then that they would go to war come what may, and that everything that happened in the subsequent year, you know, the Americans were able to... the Americans could go to war for regime change. In Britain, that was totally illegal. They weren't allowed to do that, and therefore Blair had to find some other way of taking Britain to war. And that's why we had the dossier with the WMD, that's why we had all the lies that were repeatedly told over all this kind of thing. And of course, there's a very famous memo that Chilcot disclosed, that Blair sends to Bush, where he says, I will be with you, whatever, you know, this kind of slightly adolescent sort of, you know, I'll follow you anywhere sort of thing, you know. And so anyway, all of those were the main points that Chilcot said. And he was as damning as it could possibly be without saying, you know, it stopped short of saying that he had lied, and it stopped short of saying that he should be prosecuted. But in fact, everything that is said in that report points in that direction. There's no question about that. And that was, I mean, and what's incredible is that Blair, the same day as this report was announced, what does Blair do? He has this massive press conference in Westminster, attended by the usual subservient BBC journalists who really love him and all the other journalists, where he says, you know, they haven't said I'm a liar, they haven't said this, they haven't said that. I mean, you know, I think it's almost sort of pathological, really, Blair's refusal to kind of admit that, you know, that he's done anything wrong. And, you know, he keeps saying, I'll do it all again. I noticed that he's planning a return to British politics to save everybody from Brexit and everything else. And all I can say is, you know, God help us, really, if that's what's going to happen. Now, what do we kind of get out of the Chilcot report, if you think about what it, you know, the sort of lessons of it for us? Well, I mean, I suppose the first lesson I would say is that it's very good to get these kind of reports when you eventually do get them, but really, millions of people in this country had come to pretty much these conclusions without the expertise, the, you know, the detailed evidence, the millions and millions of pounds that were spent on this inquiry. So you do kind of think, well, okay, it's better than not having the inquiry, but surely somebody, in a real democracy, people should have listened to what millions of people were demonstrating. Millions of people were demonstrating, let alone all the other people who were sceptical about this war. So I suppose that's the first thing that I feel. It was a real denial of democracy, I think, in a very, very real sense. And I think if you look at the discontent with politicians, which obviously isn't just a British phenomenon, but I think one of the reasons people are so discontented with politicians is because they lied to them so much over the war, and people are so resentful about the war. I mean, even if you look, I was going to say something about Donald Trump towards the end. I don't want to depress people too much by, you know, talking too much about him. But, you know, even if you look, I was very interested at immediately after he won, a couple of people said things which I thought were very interesting. A woman called Madea Benjamin, who some of you may have come across, who's an American activist, and she's in a thing called Code Pink, and she does loads of sort of direct action and things like that. She said she was on a train in Illinois, in the Midwest, and she met a guy, I think who worked on the railway by that time, who was an ex-soldier. And he said that he and all the soldier, ex-soldiers he knew were going to vote for Trump because he said there wouldn't be any more wars. Now, I'll come on to why I think that's not necessarily the case. But it's very interesting that that was how they perceived him vis-a-vis Clinton. And there was another, there was a woman interviewed in The Guardian about why she voted for Trump. And her reason was, Hillary Clinton says she's going to immediately impose a no-fly zone on Syria, and I don't want that, so I'm voting for Trump. Now, you can argue neither of these are necessarily good reasons to vote for Trump, but it does make you realise that anybody now who talks about being against these wars, whether it's from the right or from the left, actually does get an audience around those things, precisely because it was so unpopular. So I think that's one of the elements of it. I think the lesson about politicians in general is that the politicians have totally, on most politicians in most parties, I mean, there's some exceptions in which I include Jeremy Corbyn, who's always been absolutely solidly anti-war and still is solidly anti-war, and against a huge amount of bile and vilification all the time, in particularly in the right-wing media. But, you know, if you look at how politicians responded to Chilcot, it's very interesting. Jeremy Corbyn that day held an event in Westminster where he invited ex-soldiers, he invited some of the families of the people who've been killed in Iraq, some Iraqis, and anti-war campaigners. And he apologised on behalf of the Labour Party for the Iraq War, which is the very least, that, in my opinion, that anybody should do. There was a debate in Parliament a week later about Chilcot, which was one of, and this, I mean, you know, we know the bar's pretty low here, but it was one of the worst, debates that I've heard in Parliament, because one after the other, they get up and they say, if we'd known what we know now, then maybe we wouldn't have voted for it. But, well, don't hold your breath, because they vote for every other war, so they almost certainly would. But they just get up and say that, and then they say, but anyway, Saddam Hussein was a dictator. You know, all the arguments they churned out 12, 13, 14 years ago, they're still churning them out. They've learned absolutely nothing from them. The second thing I think it tells us something about is about the media, which, again, with a few notable exceptions, and people will remember that, I mean, obviously the left-wing press is anti-war and, you know, had a good record on all of this. The Daily Mirror also was anti-war, although its editor got sacked as a result of that, not very long after the Iraq War, Piers Morgan. I mean, you don't feel terribly sorry for him, but you know, he definitely got sacked because he took the wrong position on the war. And the Daily Mirror actually did mobilise for the demonstration on February the 15th, which made a difference to reaching people that perhaps we don't always reach when we're doing all those sorts of things. But by and large, the press was just appalling about these kind of things. You don't get the truth, you get... I mean, I was reminded of it a little bit with the death of Castro this week. And whatever you think about Castro, and we probably have different positions about Cuba and what we think of Cuba and so on. But, you know, the idea that there's absolutely nothing good you can say about it is that actually, you know, when I compare Cuba with, say, Jamaica or Haiti or any of the other places in the region which have suffered so much and where people are much less healthy and less educated and all those sorts of things, you just think they can't ever do a sort of balanced, serious report of what's going on. And particularly with the war stuff, it was incredible. The BBC sent a letter to its employees saying that they could not go on the demonstrations around the Iraq War because that would be breaching their impartiality. This is the impartiality where, you know, the debates most of the time are between people who think war's okay without a UN resolution or war's okay with a UN resolution. You know, there's never a kind of war's not okay. That's not allowed as a serious position. Or if you are allowed on occasionally, you're just attacked from all sides and, you know, regarded as some kind of nutcase who's just, you know, who's just sort of wandered into the BBC and they get you out as quickly as possible. So I think the press played a very, very bad role, and I think they still do it now. We don't get the truth about any of the things that are really going on. We don't get the truth about Syria. We don't get the truth about what's going on in Yemen. We don't get the truth about Libya. And we don't get the truth about Iraq, where actually there's another humanitarian crisis going on around Mosul, which we barely hear about from the BBC. So there's those things as well. How am I doing for time? I probably ought to try and draw my remarks to a close. But there's also the wider questions, you know, which aren't touched on by Chilcot. The questions of the arms deals, you know, who is supplying the Saudis with arms that they're using in Yemen. The arms sales, I mean, the arms industry is such an important industry to British capitalism now, such an important industry, and therefore, you know, there's this constant argument, oh, you can't do anything about this because it will affect jobs and all those sorts of questions that come up. And, of course, the oil, which, you know, is always regarded as a kind of, oh, you know, you can't just say it's about oil. But then on the other hand, you do have to say the oil is a very important part of what is going on in Iraq today, in Libya, where, you know, there's what, three governments and ISIS are all fighting it out in Libya for control of the economy. And all those different kind of things. So just to really conclude, where does this leave us today? Well, I think partly we still have to try to hold Blair to account. Now, I don't really have much hope that you're ever going to get him in front of a court, partly because the International Criminal Court is set up to try, you know, dictators from African republics and the Balkans and so on. It's not, well, the Americans don't even recognise it, and you know, it isn't designed to put Tony Blair or anybody of his sort of standing on trial. So I think we'll wait a long time for that. I do think we could have a campaign to have Blair barred from public office, and Jack Straw and some of these other people, which wouldn't be, you know, wouldn't be the greatest thing in the world. But I do feel slightly sickened at the thought that he's setting up some office in Westminster with millions of pounds, which will be against the Labour leadership, we know, and will be against everything that we stand for. So I think some of those things would be important. But also, and this brings me back to Trump. You know, there's some people who think, well, Trump, obviously these people who voted for him because he wouldn't take them into wars, think Trump is less belligerent than Hillary Clinton. Well, you know, I mean, I just think you've got to look at, I mean, A, he's completely unpredictable. B, his level of racism is such that, you know, whether it's Muslims or Mexicans or anybody in Latin America and a whole lot of other people around the world, he really doesn't rate very highly. You know, though, that kind of racism is a driver of war, to tell the truth. It's a driver of conflict, and it's a driver of all those sorts of things. He's going to raise arms spending considerably. He's talking about extending nuclear weapons to countries like South Korea. You know, I can't really think of a more stupid idea, but it's obviously one that he's got. So, and there's the whole intractable problem of the Middle East, which these, what, 13 years of intervention has done nothing but harm, really, in the whole region. There's still the problem of Afghanistan. There's still the question of Eastern Europe, where we're told it's all Russian aggression and nothing to do with the EU, you know, or nothing to do with anybody else there. So all of these, it strikes me, mean that, and also there's a huge American establishment which is committed to war and intervention, and I don't believe that any president will get the better of them. That is the truth of it. So however exactly it pans out, I think we're looking to more wars. The economic crisis and the political crisis, which is now gripping the world, you know, the rise of the far right and the prospect of Marine Le Pen in France next year, you know, the Italian referendum, which looks like it's going to signal the beginning of the end of Italy in the EU. This is all a period of great instability economically, politically, and socially. And therefore, I think the wars, we have to factor in as a major part of all of that. And that means we need an anti-war movement which is vibrant, which is growing, which can really deal with these issues and get on the streets when we need to get on the streets and to lobby MPs and to do all the other things that we do. I don't want to end on, I mean, it makes it sound pretty kind of grim, I suppose, the way that I've ended. I don't want to do that because I actually think that there are huge possibilities of change and of hope in the world. And I think that, you know, there are many, many people who agree with the kind of things that we're saying. And you know, the fact that the Labour Party is bigger than it's been for decades and you've got a left-wing leader in the Labour Party actually is a big source of hope in this country and one that we should be very encouraged by. But I suppose what I'm arguing is it's not a time where you can sort of sit down and not do things. It's a time when actually we've got to be saying, okay, there is this threat of the right. How do we combat it? How do we fight racism? How do we fight wars? How do we fight all these different things? And, you know, I think the lesson coming out of Chilcot is we were right to oppose the war when we did. We've been absolutely vindicated by all those things. And now we have to continue that struggle, both in terms of Blair himself, both in terms of Chilcot, but as importantly, on linking those with the fight against austerity, the fight against racism, and the fight against war. Thank you.